from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Nigeria's election called a significant event. Iran talks continue past their deadline. Is an end to martial law in Thailand a cause for celebration? And the 70th anniversary of the storming of Okinawa.
The experience of Okinawa and the ferocity of the battle and the number of casualties was some of the reasoning that went into the dropping of the atomic bomb.
I'm Susan Yonke. Nigeria's president-elect, Muhammadu Buhari of the All Progressives Party, today praised his rival, incumbent Goodluck Jonathan, for conceding Saturday's election and calling on him Tuesday to congratulate him on his victory. Mr. Buhari thanked the outgoing president for his statesmanship and extended his hand of fellowship. Mr. Buhari won by more than 2.5 million votes, a convincing win, despite allegations of some voting irregularities. It represents the West African country's first civilian transfer of power from one party to another. John Campbell, senior fellow in African Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, tells VOA's Victor Beatty it is a significant event.
What it did was it effectively forestalled claims by the ruling party that the elections were either rigged or were not credible. It forestalled those claims.
Here's how the French press agency puts it. With dissatisfaction over security, corruption, and the faltering economy, and as oil revenues fell, voters turned out in force, sensing an unprecedented opportunity for change.
Buhari campaigned on really two broad themes. The first was corruption, and the second was that the incumbent government was failing to provide security for Nigerian nationals. This referred both to Boko Haram, but it also referred to the widespread kidnapping that goes on all over the country.
Political commentator Chris Ungwodo said the victory, quote, had instigated the supremacy and primacy of the electorate in a country where elections had generally been a foregone conclusion for the incumbent.
And that's exactly right. Elections had been a foregone conclusion for the incumbent until now.
Can we say that's true across Africa? And will this send a message to other African leaders?
It should send a message to other African leaders. It's not true universally. There are countries in Africa where the opposition has come to power through elections. Senegal is one, for example. However, Nigeria is far larger than any other country in Africa, and hence what happens there is of much greater significance than what happens elsewhere.
Apparently, a lot of Christians did vote for a Muslim candidate.
Indeed, they did. They have done so before. The polarization between Muslims and Christians has been a relatively recent phenomenon in Nigeria.
Now, Mr. Buhari's been elected. Now he's got to deliver. Do you think he's the man to do the job?
Well, the problems are enormous. Boko Haram is not going away. Boko Haram, in fact, attempted to kill him some months ago. A President Buhari also faces a potential insurrection in the Niger Delta, the oil patch, an area where various Delta militants had said that if President Jonathan was not returned to office, they would renew their attacks on oil infrastructure. Then there is the issue of the remarkable fall in oil prices. Oil accounts for more than 70% of the revenue of the Nigerian state and more than 90% of its foreign exchange. So what the fall in the price of oil has done is, in effect, it's cut the revenue of the Nigerian state in half. Loss of that kind of revenue makes it very difficult to pursue a reformist agenda.
Campbell says with Mr. Buhari's election, there will be new opportunities for U.S. policy in Nigeria, despite lingering human rights concerns. Ministerial talks between six world powers and Iran on the future of its nuclear program continued today in Lausanne, Switzerland, hours after the deadline for reaching an interim agreement had passed. VOA's Al Pessin reports from Lausanne.
Senior officials on all sides reported progress late Tuesday, justifying their decision to keep talking past the midnight deadline. But the elusive agreement on key points had not been achieved when the sun rose over the Swiss Alps Wednesday morning. The goal is to agree on key elements of an accord and then give technical experts 3 months to draft a detailed agreement, potentially ending more than a decade of dispute over Iran's nuclear program. The accord is supposed to verifiably guarantee the program is purely peaceful, as Iran claims, and gradually lift a complex web of international economic sanctions. It appeared to be the sanctions that were the final sticking point, with negotiators unable to come up with a sequence that satisfied Iran's desire for fast relief and the international negotiators' desire to ensure Iran could not evade its commitments after sanctions end. Iran has still not met United Nations Security Council demands for a full accounting of its past secret nuclear weapons program. Many in the international community worry that Iran could do the same thing again once it's clear of the sanctions, particularly after this agreement expires, expected in 10 to 15 years. But experts say the emerging accord would provide for extensive inspections that would ensure that does not happen over the long term.
I think it's important to acknowledge that some of the monitoring and verification in an agreement will be permanent.
Kelsey Davenport of the Arms Control Association in Washington notes that as part of the deal, Iran is expected to ratify what's called the Additional Protocol of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty.
That will give the international community far greater access to Iran's nuclear facilities and also access to undeclared sites. It will also give inspectors much more latitude to investigate areas if they think that illicit nuclear activities have taken place there. Any deviations would be very quickly detected.
At Georgetown University, Ariane Tabatabai agrees that critics of the negotiations do not give enough credence to the International Atomic Energy Association's monitoring and verification program, even though Iran has cooperated with it since a preliminary accord was reached a year and a half ago.
I think that is perhaps the least talked about and the most important part of a deal. For the most part, people who talk about the Iran talks don't necessarily know much about the monitoring system. People don't necessarily know what the IAEA is doing. It's not something that you can grasp as easily.
One thing critics can grasp is that the deadline for agreement on the main points has already been missed by at least one day, and they will be looking at whatever comes out of these talks to try to figure out who made the final concessions. Skeptics, particularly in Iran and in the U.S. Congress, are expected to use whatever's announced here to try to scuttle the process before it's finished in June. But supporters of the talks warn that the alternative is a return to confrontation and the possible development of an Iranian nuclear bomb. Al Pessin, VOA News, Luzon.
For months, members of the Arab League have been calling for a joint military force to quell the violence engulfing the region. Now that member states have largely agreed, analysts say having the force materialized and preparing it to fight complex modern conflicts may be an insurmountable challenge. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from our Middle East Bureau in Cairo.
Arab heads of states and foreign ministers mostly now agree that an international force of Arab fighters must and will be formed to secure the region. This is Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi at the recent Arab League summit. He promises that military leaders will form a committee to figure out how to assemble an Arab League military force. He does not say exactly who will be in charge or where the force will go, but presumably Libya, Yemen, Iraq, and Syria currently top the list. Not all Arab League representatives agree. Iraqi Foreign Minister Ibrahim Jaafari is against intervention. He says intervention could make the conflicts worse and points out the elephant in the room. Many Arab countries are deeply divided, either internally or externally or both, with Sunni countries and groups generally allying with Saudi Arabia, and Shia countries and groups allying with Iran. With complex tribal and political divisions adding to the chaos, one regional newspaper calls the proposed unified Arab force a triple oxymoron. Abdullah Al-Ashal, a former deputy foreign minister and ambassador in Egypt, says these divisions could make it impossible for the Arab world to form a military.
Since when the Arabs are united on anything? If they are united in at any moment, tell me.
And if they did unite enough to form a military, he says conflicting alliances could escalate the fighting. For example, in Yemen, the Iranian-backed Houthis are fighting the Saudi-backed government. Intervention in Yemen, says Ashal, would be tantamount to war with Iran.
What is going to do with the force? To do what? To fight Iran? They will smash them all. Iran is very strong militarily.
But international forces are desperately needed to counter the threat of the so-called Islamic State militant group, adds political analyst Hisham Kassem. And the United States, NATO, and the United Nations are increasingly disinterested in direct Middle East intervention. As a result, he says, the Arab world has no choice but to act.
It's not an option. A force has to be created with some minimal support from the United States and Europe. Nobody at this point who is directly threatened can afford to say, none of my business or I don't want my people killed.
He says the Arab League might not be the best organization to spearhead such a force, as it does not have a long history of actually getting things done. And the current plan will be hindered by the refusal of some countries to participate, along with the lack of military capacity of others. Also, Egypt's massive army is likely to be a key player in any joint Arab force, he says. But the Egyptian army is designed to fight wars with other armies, not militant groups.
The powerful army that will be at the core of it is the Egyptian army. But I don't think that they're ready to shift from an army that is capable of confrontation with another state, i.e. Israel, and turn into a counter-terrorism military.
If the Egyptian army did make the shift, he says, it could jeopardize the balance of power in the Middle East. On the other hand, he adds, alliances in the Middle East are also shifting. And while groups and nations may be divided, the people are largely united against the Islamic State. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
Thailand's king is expected to give permission for an end to months of martial law in the country. But as VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok, many are not viewing this as a cause for celebration.
The end to more than 10 months of martial law in Thailand is not being celebrated by legal experts and defenders of human rights. They are warning martial law is being replaced with the application of a section of a provisional charter that will give the leader of the kingdom's junta even more power. Thailand's National Human Rights Commission, which is not known for taking bold stands, is bluntly warning that revoking martial law and applying Article 44 of the Interim Charter, which replaced the Constitution after the May 22nd coup, will give Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha absolute authority. Sunay Phasuk, the senior researcher in Thailand for the international organization Human Rights Watch, agrees.
That will allow General Prayut, Prime Minister, and the junta leader to consolidate powers in his hand to the point that he can order anyone to do or not to do anything. He has ultimate powers now, unlimited, unchecked, and his action can be done with total impunity.
Sunay says regardless of the Prime Minister's assurances to act responsibly, his organization cannot see how application of the interim charter can lead to any improvement in the rights situation in Thailand.
Under Section 44, orders will be issued to allow the military to arrest and detain dissidents, put them in incommunicado military detention for at least 7 days. That is no different from the ongoing situation under martial law.
Thailand has come under pressure from the diplomatic community to end martial law imposed 2 days prior to the coup. Officials of the junta-led government insist the controversial article in the interim charter will only be used to urgently solve national problems without violating human rights. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
17 years ago today, the U.S. 10th Army stormed ashore on Okinawa, an island about 640 kilometers south of Japan, in what would be the last campaign of the Pacific Theater of World War II. It was the largest all-American amphibious operation. 180,000 soldiers and Marines fought to capture the island and use it as a staging area for the eventual invasion of central Japan. When the 82-day battle was over, more than 12,000 Americans and hundreds of thousands of Japanese soldiers and Okinawan civilians were killed. Len Lazarek is founder and editor of the MarylandReporter.com website, and his father was a wounded combat infantryman. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the ferocity of the battle would play a significant part in the decision to drop two atomic bombs on Japan to forestall the need for an invasion.
This was the largest amphibious invasion of the Pacific. And as a matter of fact, it is actually the largest amphibious invasion involving American troops. This was a completely American operation. They wanted to grab this fairly large island as a base for operations for the eventual invasion of the home islands of Japan.
70 years on, why should Americans, anyone else in the world, care about Okinawa?
Because of the tremendous loss of life there, because it is actually continues to be the American base closest to China and all of East Asia, and because the experience of Okinawa and the ferocity of the battle and the number of casualties was some of the reasoning that went into the dropping of the atomic bombs, because there was a general feeling not only by the command level in Washington and by these grunt soldiers was that Okinawa was a terrible battle, but the invasion of Japan would be even worse, that the Japanese would fight even harder and there would be more American dead, more Japanese dead, more civilian deaths than were on Okinawa, which was significant in itself. More than 200,000 people died in this. A third of the population of the island died.
When people talk about World War II history, what immediately comes to mind, of course, is Pearl Harbor, the D-Day invasion, Normandy in France. And even Iwo Jima with that iconic photograph of the flag raising on Mount Suribachi. But very few people talk about Okinawa.
That's partly due to the coverage of the time. It started on April 1st, which happened to be Easter Sunday, 1945. The amphibious landing itself was totally different from D-Day. The Japanese had decided that they were not going to resist the invasion. So essentially, the Marines and soldiers marched onto the island unimpeded, and it was the Japanese strategy that they were going to engage them when they got to the foothills and the caves of this island. 12 days later, Franklin Roosevelt died, and then there was the rush to Berlin across Europe, and the war in Europe ended 5 or 6 weeks after this invasion. So there was a lot of distraction to the coverage of the time, and it was a faraway place, and it was not a pretty picture.
The United States turned Okinawa over to Japanese control in 1972, but maintains a network of military bases there, which are a source of growing discontent among the civilian population over accidents, noise pollution, environmental damage, and crime. The governor, Takeshi Onaga, won election last December on a platform to slow plans to relocate the U.S. Marine Corps Futenma Air Station on the island as part of a force realignment. His supporters want U.S. forces withdrawn altogether, or at least reduced. However, Japan, confronted with a rising China, welcomes the continued U.S. presence. South Africa's comedy community is beside itself after the announcement that South African comedian Trevor Noah will take over from Jon Stewart as host of the most popular political satire program in the United States, The Daily Show. In South Africa, the mixed-race comedian is loved for his edgy jibes about race and language. But will he get lost in translation in the U.S.? From Johannesburg, VOA's Anita Powell talks with some of the nation's comedy elite.
The comedian known as Deep Fried Man, real name Daniel Friedman, was in poor shape to speak to VOA News the morning after the epic announcement that South African comic Trevor Noah will take the helm of the popular satirical American news program, The Daily Show. That's because, Friedman croaked, he and fellow cast members of Late Night News with Louis Segola, South Africa's version of The Daily Show, had an impromptu blowout party to celebrate Monday night.
Everyone basically went crazy. It was an amazing atmosphere because all the people I work with have sort of either less or more degrees of separation from Trevor, and most of the team have worked with him before, and some of the team know him really well. It was very distracting because we were still in the middle of shooting an episode, and I have no idea how we managed to finish the episode.
The show's content producer, Carabo Ledija, also a bit worse for wear after the celebratory bash, said her show would not exist if not for The Daily Show. She said she is excited about the serious possibilities of Noah's new job.
For Trevor, in that spot, that amazing, spectacular spot, it just means a better opportunity of us to be just normal, you know, like everybody else around the world. And I think that for me, is the powerful thing about this.
Noah has often touched on this subject in his comedy, lambasting Western views of Africa as impoverished and behind the times. Friedman says comedy can be a serious business. In troubled societies, it can be a gentle way of shining a light on ugly truths. That, he says, is Noah's specialty. But he worries about how far more politically correct American audiences can be pushed.
Trevor is already in person, a lot more than on Twitter, very able to discuss difficult concepts in a non-offensive way. And he's so charming that he can pretty much go anywhere. But I think his biggest challenge is going to be the fact that I think the U.S. has a bit of a lower threshold for controversial comedy than we do.
Ledija agrees that Noah has room to explore sticky issues of race, but says she's not sure how he will approach it.
Man, I have no idea, but America has its own race issues, and maybe that's good, but they're discussed, I think. You know, I think America has their own race issues to talk about a lot, so maybe it's not such a bad thing.
Whatever happens, it's going to be interesting. Stay tuned, world. Here comes Trevor Noah. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thank you for joining us for International Edition. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. State Department is partnering with the private sector to promote entrepreneurship among women around the world and in the Middle East and Northern Africa in particular. Most recently, the State Department joined with Goldman Sachs 10,000 Women and Harvard Kennedy School to develop the first ever cross-border exchange and leadership program to support emerging women leaders in the Middle East and Northern Africa. This public-private partnership between government, academia, and the private sector aims to cultivate the leadership potential of women in the region, promote women's economic empowerment, and strengthen entrepreneurship. It is critically important for the people of this region, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, to get their economies moving, and women are essential for the region to realize its potential. Time and again, he said, we see the countries with the greatest representation of women in management positions deliver a higher return to shareholders than those who push women out. So the bottom line is simple, said Secretary Kerry. No country can get ahead if it leaves half its people behind. No economy can thrive if women are denied a seat at the table. In the Middle East, there is significant discrimination against women. Women participate in the workplace in the region at only half the rate found in other parts of the world. The result is immense loss of productivity for the region. Aside from opportunity, women need access to education and professional training that prepares them to enter the workforce. The U.S. government and its private sector partners are working to equip women with the tools necessary to be successful entrepreneurs. To that end, the State Department is continuing to partner with the private sector to invest in women at all levels. Tech Women, an international exchange program that supports U.S. foreign policy goals and technology, increases the trade capacity of its partners and helps women reach their full potential in the tech industry. The Fortune U.S. State Department Global Women's Mentoring Partnership connects senior women business executives in the United States with emerging women business leaders from around the world. Countries in the Middle East and Northern Africa and around the globe must understand that when women thrive, their economies will thrive.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.